Let's meet the press. Today's guest on Meet the Press is Frederick H. Boland, the permanent representative of Ireland to the United Nations. Our panel consists of Marcus Child, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Clifton Daniel, New York Times, Pauline Frederick, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak. Here is our moderator, Ned Brooks.
Our guest today is Ambassador Frederick H. Boland, the permanent representative of Ireland to the United Nations. Ambassador Boland presided over the opening of the new session of the UN General Assembly, thus completing his one-year term as president. He has been prominently mentioned as a possible successor to the late Dag Hammarskjöld as Secretary General of the UN. And now here is the first question from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Ambassador, it's been widely reported in our press, and I believe in the press of the world, that Mr. Khrushchev is out to rule or ruin the United Nations. Do you believe that's true?
I can't say what is in the mind of Mr. Khrushchev, but I know that there are proposals now before the UN put forward by the Soviet delegation, which in my view would seriously impair the utility and effectiveness of the United Nations for the future.
Do you think that the Soviet Union today has the power in the United Nations to wreck the UN?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that, but of course the primary purpose of the UN, the primary purpose of us all, is to try to maintain a minimum of agreement and reconciliation between the major powers. Once the major powers fall out, then of course the UN is in peril.
Mr. Ambassador, I believe you represented Ireland at the League of Nations in its disintegrating days. Do you see any similar signs of disintegration in the United Nations today?
Yes, I do. I think there is the same tendency nowadays as there was then on the part of the major powers to take the view that the world organization should be subservient to their respective national interests. And I think there may be also a tendency, which I hope won't materialize, on the part of the smaller members of the organization to say, rather than have any serious great power differences, let us compromise.
Do you believe that they will compromise?
I bear in mind the words which Dag Hammarskjöld used in a statement to the Assembly last October, I think, when he said that he would rather that the organization broke on the question of principle than that it should drift on the basis of compromise.
Do you feel the same way, Mr. Ambassador?
I do.
Mr. Ambassador, people keep saying that the death of Secretary General Hammarskjöld is responsible for the present UN crisis. Actually, isn't it true that there would be no crisis in the UN today except for the Soviet Union and their recalcitrance?
Well, I don't think, leave the Soviet Union out of it for the moment. There are two separate concepts as to what the world organization should be. One is that it should be simply a kind of conference, you see, to reconcile different interests and ideologies among the great powers, and that it should have a secretariat in which those interests and ideologies would be balanced and reconciled. That is one concept. The other concept starts with that idea, but it goes on to think of the world organization as the instrument of the world community organized for effective international action to preserve peace, to avoid conflicts arising, and to deal with them in their early stages when they do.
And is the latter the kind of UN that you favor?
Most certainly.
We'll continue the questions with Mr. Daniel.
Ambassador Boland, you said a moment ago that you felt that one of the aims of the great powers in the United Nations was to make that organization subservient to them. Do you consider that the Soviet proposal for a three-man secretariat is a part of such a move by the Soviet Union?
I hope that I didn't say anything to suggest that that was the policy of all the great powers, although I suppose to a certain extent it's always embarrassing for any great power when it finds the world organization acting on lines which are not in keeping with its own policy. But I do think that the Soviet Union by its proposal of the Troika, and to introduce the principle of political distribution of posts into the Secretariat, would definitely deprive the World Organization of any possibilities of independent and effective and impartial international action. I think it would hamstring it.
That being the case, what chances of success do you think the Soviet plan has at this moment, the present state of opinion in the United Nations?
Well, that question has to be answered by the general membership of the UN. You remember what Dag Hammarskjöld said, it's for the small and medium states of the organization to whom the organization is really important, because it is really an important safeguard of their security and their economic and social progress and well-being. It's for them to make up their minds.
Do you have any opinion as to how the small and medium states are making up their minds and what direction?
I think a very large majority of them, indeed, are anxious to preserve an independent and effective world organization. And Ireland is certainly one of those states.
Do you think that the Soviet Union would agree to anything less than their proposal, their Troika proposal, their proposal for a three-man secretariat?
Well, I wouldn't like to predict what attitude the Soviet Union will finally take. They have indicated their views informally, I think, to a number of members, and I think that the major endeavor before the membership of the organization at the moment is to try and find some common ground, some possibility of maintaining a really effective and independent secretariat as the executive arm of the World Organization, and on the other hand, satisfying the views of the Soviet Union.
Do you yourself have a specific suggestion for reaching this common ground?
I find it very hard to, well, I have no positive suggestion. I don't think the stage has arrived at which people should crystallize their thought on specific solutions. But it does seem to me that whatever solution is adopted must safeguard two principles. One is the independence and integrity of the post of Secretary General, and the other is the international character of the UN Secretariat.
Ms. Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, do you count, believe that the General Assembly will reach some decision on an interim Secretary General, perhaps this week or next?
Well, quite obviously, I think everybody would prefer that the post of Secretary General, which is now vacant, should be filled in accordance with Article 97 of the Covenant, which provides that in the case of a vacancy, the Security Council will make a recommendation to the Assembly, and the Assembly will then decide by a two-thirds majority. There is a strong feeling that the terms of the Charter should be followed as far as possible. If the Security Council doesn't agree, then the question will arise for everybody whether they're prepared to go on with the World Organization without a Secretary General or somebody discharging the functions of the office.
Would you be willing to serve as Acting Secretary General if a majority of the delegates requested you to do so?
I would honestly think with that question, that likelihood is very unlikely to arise. In fact, it's not going to arise at all. Even if it did arise, I would earnestly and respectfully ask to be excused. That's partly a matter of instinct, but partly a matter of reason, too.
Now, to that other major problem facing the United Nations, the Katanga Information Service, which, as you know, has offices here in New York on Fifth Avenue, is giving wide publicity to charges that the United Nations has made itself an instrument of communism in the Congo, that the UN is conducting a military and police state operation against anti-communist President Tshombe of Katanga. What do you say to those charges?
Well, I think my comment on that would be, I think one of the most extraordinary features of the recent events in the Katanga were the extraordinary reports which were published by the press here and elsewhere, including in my country, on the strength of messages from agencies like the Katanga Free Press, from which nobody had ever heard at all before, And these reports were published quite uncritically, and they all turned out to be completely false without substance. The charges that the UN is acting in Katanga on behalf of communism or anything like that is simply rubbish.
Now, I understand that this same Katanga publicity organization here in New York is spreading the story that the UN started the fighting in Katanga without the authorization of the Charter or the Security Council. Is that true?
I would say not, but the full circumstances of what happened on the morning of the 13th September have been the subject of a report by the officer in charge at Leopoldville. And it's perfectly clear, so far as any evidence can go, that not only had the UN not contemplated anything in the nature of fighting or anything like that, but they only defended themselves when they were attacked, and that the attack came from the other side.
Some American officials believe this Katanga Information Service, as well as Shambe and Katanga itself, are under the control of the big European mining combine, Union Minière. What would you say to that? Do you
have I'd say that is speculation. It may be well-founded speculation, but it being speculation, I wouldn't comment on it. But there's no doubt at all, I think, that Chombe and his colleagues have the sympathy of the large firms in Katanga. That's one of the problems you have to face.
Mr. Childs.
In this same connection, Ambassador Boland, you were president of the Assembly when the resolution was adopted, which authorized the UN to act in Katanga and to resort to force if necessary. Now, it's been said very often that the commanders in the field, including the commander of the Irish forces, exceeded their authority. Do you believe this is true?
I don't. I know the commander in the field. I'm certain that he wouldn't act on his own, and I'm sure that whatever they did was in accordance with authority, and by authority I mean with decisions taken and authority given to them by the Secretary General.
In other words, they were carrying out the orders of the Secretary General, Mr. Hammershaw.
They were acting in accordance with authorities given to them by him.
And had no choice but to do what they did.
Well, that's what I believe.
Now, the other side of that coin is the charge that European mercenaries prevented the UN from carrying out its function in Katanga, and that if it had not been for 200 or 300 mercenaries, it would not have been, the operation would have succeeded. Do you believe that is true?
Yes, I think the extent of the evidence available leads me to believe that that is the case. If it hadn't been for the foreign mercenaries there leading the Katangese troops, I doubt there would have been any fighting at all. I believe there would not have been.
I know that there is, at least there was rumored to be, an investigation about the causes of the death of Mr. Hammershaid. Do you subscribe at all to the speculation that his death resulted from the action of these same mercenaries?
Well, once again, we're faced with that complete conflict of evidence. There have been statements made by on both sides, both by the survivor of the crash, who survived for a few days, Mr. Julian, and also on behalf of the authorities in Rhodesia. It's not possible to judge without a much more detailed and careful investigation than has been carried out up to date.
I know how close you were to Mr. Hammershaid and how much you admired him. Do you believe that he was an indispensable man and that it would be impossible to find anyone to use the authority of the United Nations as he used it?
Well, I think what you have said is very near to the truth. I myself, in the statement that I issued after his death, I said the world community had suffered an irreparable loss. I paused over that word, irreparable. It's a word usually associated with exaggeration. But on consideration, I believe it. I put it down because I thought it was right. I think it'd be almost impossible to replace him.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, on what grounds do you justify the use of force against Chumba in what seems like an internal affair in the Congo?
Well, I think for that you have to go back to the report that was made by the officer in charge, Leopoldville, after the events of the 13th September. What is quite clear is that there was no intention whatever on the part of the UN forces that force should eventuate. They took action on that morning to safeguard their communications, there's the post office, and to take over the radio station because there were broadcasts being made which were creating a very serious problem, a threat of civil war. And civil war is the one case in which, as you know, under the resolution of the 21st of February, the UN might be obliged to use force.
Wasn't their objective, however, to force Katanga into the Congo group?
No.
Not under a federation? Were they willing to allow Chumba and Katanga to remain independent?
No, it's quite clear. The UN on the 13th September didn't act with such a political objective. It acted with a much narrower local objective, and that was to prevent the situation in Elizabethville and in Katanga erupting into civil war and disorder and violence.
Well, even though the civil war resulted from an attack on Chumba by some of the other groups?
It is provided in the Security Council decision of the 21st February that the UN should prevent civil war in the Congo by resort to force in the last resort if necessary.
Well, are you saying then that the United Nations did not try to prevent Katanga from fighting for its independence? Mm-hmm. For example, it voted in favor of the Algerian fight for independence. It voted in favor of the Angola's fight for independence. Was it willing to allow Katanga to fight for its own independence?
No, I think that question I don't think arise. As I say, on the 13th September, I think the UN forces in the Congo acted with a limited local objective, which was to prevent disorder and so on breaking out in Katanga. Now, on the larger question of the independence of Katanga, the position which is common ground, I think, to almost the entire membership of the UN, perhaps not to all, but to the vast majority, is that, if possible, the unity and territorial integrity of the Congo should be preserved.
By force, if necessary.
That has never been spelled out, but the aim of the operation there was to help the Congo to get on its feet and to become independent and to maintain its territorial integrity and unity.
Well, why should the UN decide to do that there, but not decide to keep Angola with the Portuguese and to keep Algeria with the French?
Well, I think the simple answer is that there's no analogy whatever between the two cases, because I don't think that there is any acceptance, any wide acceptance, among the membership of the UN, as I don't think there is among the population of France, that Algeria is an integral part of France. But I think there's a very wide acceptance in the UN of the fact that Katanga is an integral part of the Congo.
By Chumba, too?
Maybe not on the part of Chumba. I'm talking about what the feeling is at the UN. This territory has been won in the past, and we're anxious to keep its territorial unity and integrity in the future.
Mr. Daniel.
Ambassador Boland, for 11 or 12 years now, the Soviet Union and others have been trying to get Communist China into the United Nations. The issue is before the UN again this year. Do you think we will get to a vote on that issue this time, or will there be further maneuvers to prevent a final vote this session?
Well, I think the issue is likely to come to the vote in one form or another during the present session, but exactly what the votes will be on, I couldn't at the moment tell you, because no specific proposals have been put down. All that has happened so far is that it has been decided to inscribe the question on the agenda. But we have no specific resolutions down yet.
Have you, from your vantage point as an assembly, past the president of the assembly, observed any change in the attitude of the various nations on this question over the past year or so?
Not basically, I think. Well, there have, some countries have changed their attitude and have stated it publicly. But I don't think there's any very wide, I don't think that change is widespread. You have, which you've had for many years, the two conflicting trends of opinion. One is that this country with its big population should be a member of the United Nations because the United Nations is by definition a universal organization. And the other feeling is that since the communist China has broken practically, well, I don't say every article in the covenant, but has violated quite a large number of the articles in the covenant, that it's simply not fit for membership of the UN.
What is your own view as to the possibility that the communist China will come into the United Nations?
Well, I wish I were a political, I wish I were able to make that kind of political prophecy. I wouldn't like to forecast at the moment what kind of decision will come out of the consideration of this matter at the present session. I think it would be brave men who did.
Ms. Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, if we may go back to the Congo for a moment. Inasmuch as Antoine Gizenga has become deputy premier in the central government, does this mean that communism has gotten a foothold in the central government and poses a real threat to Central Africa?
Well, I think one would want very close knowledge of the local political circumstances in the Congo to be able to express a firm opinion on that. Personally, I don't think so. I don't think so. I would think that we're always too afraid of the fact that somebody, because he has left-wing views or has been associated with left-wing countries, that they're going to go communist and throw their countries into the arms of the Soviet Union. I think that's overdone. I think the present premier of Congo is giving fine leadership to his country, Mr. Adula, and I think that he has very substantial sections of the country behind him, and I think that provides a valuable safeguard for the time being.
Now, as to the overall picture of the Congo operation, we know that it was facing bankruptcy at the end of the last session. The Secretary General Hammarskjöld had gone so that there's no active executive head to pursue the necessary leadership that might be required to put this thing back on its feet. Do you feel that the UN is facing the necessity of winding up the Congo operation, withdrawing its forces, simply because the delegates have not faced up to the fact they haven't paid for it?
Well, I think if that sort of thing happened, it would be really another stone, you know, in the death of the UN. That's one of the things that the World Organization should be able to prevent. It would be really a shame to the World Organization if a useful operation, an operation of this kind, foundered at the 11th hour owing to the refusal of people to pay the cost.
We have about 2.5 minutes left, Mr. Childs.
I'd like to take you to another field, Ambassador Boland. What can the UN do to help resolve the crisis over Berlin?
Well, I don't think it can do anything at the moment. I don't think that a large organization like the UN is the best forum in which to debate the kind of issues which are tied up in the Berlin situation. But if, as time went on, no solution for the Berlin situation were found, and the Berlin question became a serious threat to world peace and security, then I think it would become a matter for the UN, and it would probably come into the Assembly, and there would be widespread expressions, pressures to try and achieve some agreement or solution.
What about some of these proposals that have been made to move the entire UN organization to West Berlin as a way of helping to preserve the freedom of that city?
My experience is that there's no widespread support for those.
Or even taking some of the related agencies and locating them in Berlin?
Well, that might happen. That might happen. But I don't find any widespread support for the idea of moving the headquarters of the UN to Berlin.
Miss Frederick?
Mr. Ambassador, will the General Assembly order an investigation into the death of Secretary General Hammarskjöld?
There is a proposal down to that effect. What the ultimate decision will be on it, we have to wait and see.
Would you assume there would be voted, the resolution would be voted?
That would be my assumption.
Mr. Spivak?
Mr. Ambassador, I don't believe you told us what Ireland would do on the question of admitting Red China.
Well, as I say, we have to see, the proposal is not done. We have made it clear in our previous statements that what we are concerned about is the fact that Communist China is at the present moment in breach of some of the most important principles of the covenant.
Does that mean that you would be against admitting her then?
I would say that they would be reasons which we would take into account when it came to making up our minds.
Mr. Daniel.
Ambassador Boland. President Kennedy made a speech on disarmament and the creation of United Nations forces. What support do you find that had in the Assembly?
I think there's very widespread support for the idea which he mentioned in his speech, that countries would do well to earmark in their national forces units which would be available quickly for service as parts of UN forces.
Mr. Ambassador, I wish we had more time for our questions, but unfortunately our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll tell you about next week's guest on Meet the Press in just a moment.
In November 1863, Lincoln delivered one of the immortal speeches of all time. Yet his two-minute dedication at Gettysburg was considered so insignificant that the next day most papers carried it on the inside pages.